You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast that covers developments across all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All the comments are current at the time of podcast publication. It's brought to you by the barristers at 1 Crown Office Row, and this edition is presented by Emma-Louise Fenlon.
Traditionally, the standard of proof in the coronial court has been the balance of probabilities, other than in respect of findings of suicide or unlawful killing. Several authorities have altered and challenged this position in recent years. In the well-known case of Lewis, a majority of the Court of Appeal held that the coroner had a power, but not a duty, to leave matters that were possibly causative of death to a jury. In Tainton, the divisional court held that admitted serious, albeit non-causative, failings should have formed part of a narrative conclusion at a Middleton inquest. And finally, in Maughan, previously covered on this podcast by Jeremy Hyam QC, the High Court held that the standard of proof applicable to suicide is the balance of probabilities rather than the previously employed criminal standard of proof beyond reasonable doubt. Here with me to talk about the recent decision of Chidlow and Her Majesty's Coroner for Blackpool and Fyde, which addressed the standard of proof and causation in inquests, is Christopher Meller from 1 Crown Office Row. Chris, you're very welcome to the podcast.
Hello.
Can you tell us a little bit about the facts of the case?
Well, Mr. Chidlow brought judicial review proceedings following an inquest into the death of his brother, Carl Beebe, who had died following a cardiac arrest in circumstances where an ambulance had been called, but there had been admitted delays in it attending. The jury had heard evidence from a consultant in critical care and emergency medicine that had paramedics attended before Mr. Beebe suffered his cardiac arrest, he would, on the balance of probabilities, have survived. However, the coroner ruled that it was not safe to leave the issue of the causal link between the delay and the death to the jury. Now, Mr. Chidlow sought a declaration that that decision was unlawful and an order quashing the record of inquest and an order that there be a fresh inquest. In the event, an ambulance had been called by the police, who had attended Mr. Beebe's home following a neighbour hearing banging and screaming. And initially, the police requested an ambulance, reporting that Mr. Beebe was threatening suicide. However, having entered his flat, they found him lying on his back. He was grey, his breathing was laboured, and his pulse was fast. Thereafter, the police called the ambulance service again, stating that Mr. Beebe was now fitting, and that was at 10 minutes past midnight. Subsequently, he stopped breathing and went into cardiac arrest. Despite a number of calls to the ambulance service, the first ambulance did not arrive until 46 minutes past midnight, by which time Mr. Beebe was in asystole, that's to say that there was no electrical activity from his heart. His pupils were fixed and he was not breathing. He was certified dead at the scene at 47 minutes past midnight. Now, the evidence was that had the second call at 10 past midnight been properly coded, a rapid response vehicle would have arrived at the flat at about 20 past midnight, in other words, 26 minutes earlier.
One of the unusual aspects of this case was that four pathologists were involved.
Yes. Post-mortem examinations were conducted in July and August 2009 by two pathologists who failed to establish a medical cause of death. There was also a separate examination of Mr. Beebe's heart by a consultant cardiac pathologist who found nothing remarkable. Then two further pathologists were instructed for the purposes of the inquest, and a joint report was produced by them in conjunction with the cardiac pathologist. In the event, they agreed that the cause of death was unascertained, specifically agreeing that there was no evidence of any natural disease, that a sudden cardiac event, such as channelopathy, which had been raised as a possibility by the cardiac pathologist, was unlikely, and that there was no evidence of any toxicological cause of death. They did suggest that Mr. Beebe may have been suffering from an acute behavioural disturbance, and in that context, one pathologist considered the possibility of a link between struggling against restraint and the death. However, in evidence, he acknowledged that whilst both possible and plausible, the evidence of such a link fell short of the balance of probabilities. Therefore, the pathological evidence didn't give a medical cause of death.
The coroner also heard evidence from a consultant in critical care and emergency medicine.
Yes, that's right. His evidence was of particular importance in the judicial review proceedings. In essence, as I stated a moment ago, his evidence was that had a paramedic attended before Mr. Bibby suffered cardiac arrest, he would, on the balance of probabilities, have survived. As to the likely diagnosis, he said he was able to exclude a number of possibilities given the post-mortem findings. And having considered the remaining possible diagnoses, he similarly concluded that it was impossible to reach a diagnosis other than to say Mr. Bibby became critically ill for a period of at least 25 minutes before his cardiac arrest, although in the event, the expert thought arrhythmia was the most likely diagnosis. Furthermore, when being questioned as to what a paramedic could have done and whether it was speculation given the lack of a medical cause of death, he said that you don't have to have a diagnosis in front of you to provide emergency care and also to save a patient as well. Of particular interest was his evidence as to survivability, as in the course of that evidence he referred to statistical evidence in relation to the chances of survival in such circumstances, including where paramedics arrive before the onset of a cardiac arrest or less than 4 minutes afterwards.
And the judgment dealt specifically with the question of causation and was in many ways a helpful reminder about some of the main authorities, including Tainton and Lewis.
Yes. So notwithstanding the evidence of the consultant in critical care, the coroner ruled that the possible causal link between the ambulance delay and the death should not be left to the jury. He ruled, as summarised by Mr. Justice Pepperell in the leading judgment, that the case had to be viewed through the prism of the cause of death being unascertained, and that it would not be safe to allow the jury to speculate as to causation. As a result, and having noted that Article 2 was engaged, the court first reiterated the Galbraith Plus test, noting that the question of whether it would be safe for the jury to reach the conclusion in question, in other words, the second limb of the Galbraith Plus test, was in issue. In other words, it was not a question of the sufficiency of evidence. And the court then went through a number of authorities in relation to causation, starting with Tainton, which, as listeners will know, concerned the delayed diagnosis of cancer in a prison. And they particularly referred to paragraph 41 of the judgment in Tainton, which said as follows: it is common ground that the threshold for causation of death is not the same thing as the standard of proof required to prove causation of death. In cases such as this, the latter is proof on the balance of probabilities. It is agreed that the threshold that must be reached for causation of death to be established is that the event or conduct said to have caused the death must have more than minimally, negligibly, or trivially contributed to the death. And they referred to the case of Dawson and Her Majesty's Coroner for East Riding in Kingston upon Hull. Putting these two concepts together, the question is whether on the balance of probabilities the conduct in question more than minimally, negligibly, or trivially contributed to the death. The court then referred briefly to Lewis and the discretion, but not a duty, to leave to the jury causes of death that are merely possible, but not probable.
And in that context, the court then went on to deal with authorities specifically in relation to whether causation can be proved by statistical evidence.
Yes. As to the coronial authorities, the court referred to Kahn and Her Majesty's Coroner for West Hertfordshire, and then briefly to the case of Nichols and the Coroner for the City of Liverpool. Now, Kahn is a case that's probably familiar to listeners. There, the deceased sought to conceal a wrap of heroin by hiding it in his mouth as he was arrested, and the wrap subsequently burst. On judicial review proceedings, it was argued that the coroner should have left neglect to the jury on the basis of the police's alleged delay in calling an ambulance, it being suggested that if the ambulance had arrived 8 minutes earlier, then an antidote would have been administered with the real possibility of saving Mr. Kahn's life. Now, in the event, Mr. Justice Richards, as he then was, held that the coroner had been right not to leave causation to the jury on that basis. It was not enough, he said, that there was a real possibility rather than a probability of saving Mr. Kahn's life. and whether the antidote would probably have made a difference required evidence from medical experts, such evidence being absent. In that context, in Chidlow, the court stated that Mr. Justice Richards had plainly envisaged that such expert medical evidence could have been adduced, providing it took into account not just the general efficacy of the antidote, but also the evidence as to the drugs ingested and Mr. Khan's condition. In other words, the specifics of Mr. Khan's situation. As I mentioned a moment ago, the court then referred to the case of Nichols and the coroner for the City of Liverpool, which was the case where the deceased swallowed heroin, and the court had held the coroner had been wrong not to hear evidence from an A&E consultant in relation to the appropriateness of treatment by the police doctor, when an antidote should have been given, and the likely efficacy of the antidote. In my view, very interestingly in this context, Mr. Justice Pepperell in Chidlow then went on to consider the approach taken to statistics in clinical negligence cases. And he referred first to Hodson, an East Berkshire Health Authority, a 1987 judgment, where Lord Justice Croom Johnson in the Court of Appeal stated, "To be a figure in a statistic does not by itself give the claimant a cause of action." He then referred to the House of Lords judgment in Gregg and Scott in 2005, which, as everyone probably knows, confirmed that in a claim for clinical negligence, it must be proved on the balance of probabilities, and if it cannot be, no separate action lies upon proof of a reduced chance of a positive outcome. And then he referred to the case of Wardlow and Farrer in 2003. Now, that was a case in which the claimant relied on a study showing that 85% of patients who were hemodynamically stable upon diagnosis of a pulmonary embolus would survive. And the claimant argued that since the deceased had been hemodynamically stable when she should have been diagnosed, there having been a delay in the diagnosis, she had an 85% chance of survival. Now, in that case, in the event the claim failed, as there was evidence that the patient did not in fact respond to the usual beneficial effects of anticoagulation subsequently. She was, therefore, probably in the 15% who would not survive despite earlier treatment. And the court quoted the judgment of Lord Justice Brooke, where he stated, "While judges are, of course, entitled to place such weight on statistical evidence as is appropriate, they must not blind themselves to the effect of other evidence, which might put a particular patient in a particular category, regardless of the general probabilities."
And on the same subject, the court also referred to Clark and Linsdale on Tort, the well-known practitioner's textbook, and stated, "Care has to be exercised when relying on statistics as a means of establishing causation. The court must look at the claimant's individual circumstances rather than at the general statistics."
Yes, that's right, Emma. Indeed, they went on to quote a longer passage from Clark and Linsdale. After citing Wardlow, the editors then stated this: "On the other hand, care should be taken not to take the logic of this reasoning too far in the opposite direction. If the evidence is that, say, 80% of patients survive with prompt treatment, but 20% die even with prompt treatment, the fact that the patient died following delayed treatment does not establish that he probably fell into the 20% category at the outset, and therefore the delay did not contribute to the death. The assessment of causation would turn upon the detailed medical evidence, both as to the overall statistical chances of survival and the particular condition and circumstances of the patient." And at the end of the passage, they cited an interesting sentence: "Proof of causation is almost invariably about a burden of persuasion, and sometimes statistics can be highly persuasive when used appropriately."
Having considered the authorities, then, what did the court ultimately conclude in Chidlow?
Well, firstly, Mr. Justice Pepperell set out the principles that could be identified from the authorities he had referred to. And having set out the Galbraith Plus test and the test for causation, he stated this: "In considering whether it is safe to leave such an issue to the jury, a coroner must have regard to all relevant evidence. In addition to evidence relating to the particular deceased and the circumstances of his or her death, that may include general statistical evidence drawn from population data, such as the rate of survival in a particular group. Such general statistical evidence alone is, however, unlikely to be sufficient. For example, even where the rate is over 50%, a raw survival rate for the group into which, without the relevant event or omission, the deceased is said to fall, is unlikely to be sufficient because without evidence supporting the proposition derived from the population data, a jury could not safely conclude that he or she would have fallen into the category of survivors. And he went on, in most cases, there will be other evidence as to whether the deceased probably would or would not have fallen in the group of survivors. Where there is apparently credible additional evidence of causation, which, if accepted, together with the general statistical evidence, could properly lead the jury to find on the balance of probabilities that the event or omission more than minimally, negligibly or trivially contributed to death, then it will usually be proper and safe to leave causation to the jury. He then turned to the findings on the particular facts of Chidlow in light of those principles. And he held that in Chidlow, the expert evidence from the critical care expert was more than statistics. He had given careful consideration to possible causes of death, and he had analysed the prospects in respect of such causes. And he concluded the expert had reasonably considered and determined that Mr. Bibby was more likely than not to fall into the 80% of severely unwell patients who would be expected to survive with prompt treatment. And in this context, Emma, I'd also refer to paragraph 63, where Mr. Justice Pepperell stated this. The essence of the coroner's ruling was, however, not any principled objection to statistical evidence, but his view that any evidence as to survivability was necessarily speculative and therefore unsafe, given the absence of clear evidence as to the cause of death. In my judgment, the coroner fell into error in concluding that the lack of a clear cause of death prevented the jury from being able to consider the possible causal effect of the delay in treatment. The pathologists and Dr. Andrews, who was the critical care expert, were not addressing the same issue. Establishing the medical cause of death would plainly have assisted, but was not, as Dr. Andrews explained, essential to being able to form an opinion as to the effect of delayed treatment.
And so in terms of takeaway lessons for practitioners, where does this case fit?
Well, in my view, there are three main takeaway points. The first, as has been stated by Dominic Ruckeen in his analysis of Chidlow on the UK Human Rights blog, Chidlow is a concise and authoritative judgment, reiterating and summarising the current common law concerning causation in inquests. And in my experience, some clinical negligence practitioners can struggle with the more than minimally, negligibly or trivially contributed to the death test. As an aside, in that regard, I would highlight Mr. Justice Richard's judgment in Khan again, as I referred to earlier in Chidlow, but in a different context, namely in the context of opportunities to render care and neglect. And he stated in Khan, and this is at paragraph 43, that it still must be shown to the requisite standard of proof that care would have been rendered and that it would have saved or prolonged life. And that needs to be borne in mind when considering the minimally, negligibly or trivially contributed to the death test. And that part of Khan is referred to in the Chief Coroner's Guidance number 17 at paragraph 82. As also stated by Mr. Justice Richards in Khan, the direction in Dawson, approved by this court, is certainly an illustration of the point that causation can be established without showing that the deceased would have survived. But that is because it can be established by showing in the alternative that death, although inevitable, was hastened by the conduct in question. So again, it must be shown on the balance of probabilities that care would have saved or prolonged life. The second take-home point, in my view, is the point that was raised by Mr. Justice Pepperell at the end of the judgment, in terms of the absence of a clear medical cause of death, not meaning that there cannot be findings as to the causal effect of a delay in treatment. And thirdly, it is an important reminder and analysis of the use of statistical evidence. It can be highly persuasive, but there needs to be evidence that the deceased would or would not have fallen into the group of survivors. In other words, there needs to be evidence relating the statistics to the deceased's actual condition and presentation.
Listeners can find links to all of the cases and articles referred to in today's episode on the UK Human Rights blog. Chris, thanks very much again for coming on the podcast.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
LawPod UK was presented by Emma Louise Fenelon and is produced by One Crown Office Row. For more editions of LawPod UK, you can subscribe to the podcast and recommend us to a friend.